Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Sweatman, and today we're looking at the new sci-fi epic from director Denis Villeneuve, Dune, starring Timothée Chalamet, Zendaya, Rebecca Ferguson, Oscar Isaac, and many more. For the Dune discussion, making her triumphant return to the podcast is my very own wife, Allison Grigsby Sweatman. After that, Omaya Jones and I wrap up our Wong Kar-wai marathon looking at his short film, The Hand, and we look back at our favorite moments from the box set. And at the very top of the show, I'll give my brief reaction to the films I watched recently as part of the Hot Springs Documentary Film Festival. Stick around. There are a handful of film festivals around my home state of Arkansas, and one of the most prominent is the Hot Springs Documentary Film Festival. Taking place in beautiful Hot Springs, Arkansas, this is the longest-running documentary festival in North America, which just celebrated 30 years. It runs a whole week, and they do all sorts of things. In addition to screening lots of great films, there are panels, after parties, concerts, there's even a bike tour and a hike through the parks nearby. This year, comedian Tig Notaro came and spoke before one of the films. It's a cool event. I did not go in person, sadly. I did the virtual thing again, but I did see some really wonderful and creative documentaries, and I'm going to tell you about my favorites. One of the features I watched is called Flea. It follows a man named Amin as he tells his life story for the first time, including his experience fleeing his home country of Afghanistan. The story itself is incredibly moving, and it's interesting because the film is actually animated. So we see Amin animated being interviewed by his friend and documentarian. And as he tells the story, we flash back and we see animated recreations of his childhood and the incredibly difficult things that he and his family went through. By combining the past and present in this way, we understand the effect that this has had on Amin, and we see him begin to work through his trauma around it. It's really incredible. Next up, I watched a film called The First Wave. This follows frontline workers in New York City dealing with the first wave of COVID. The words, emotionally wrenching, don't begin to explain what it's like to watch this movie. Director Matthew Heineman has somehow gotten access to the hospital rooms and patients' personal homes to look at not only the physical effects of COVID, but also the emotional toll on the patients and their families, and not to mention the emotional toll on hospital workers. Near the end of the film, one of the hospital workers reflects on an emotional reaction that she had earlier in the film, and she says these words, "I didn't realize I was holding on to all that." And when she said that, it perfectly captured for me the experience of watching this documentary, because the first wave of COVID is something we all went through in the U.S., and reliving it through this film really brought up some feelings I didn't expect. This film captures collective trauma close up, and that makes it one of the most hard-to-watch films for me in recent memory. I do think ultimately it was a healing experience, and I think this movie is very well made, and I hope lots of people are able to see it, but man, is it a difficult film. Another feature I watched is called The Rescue. It's from the same team who made the documentary Free Solo, and it's similarly stressful to watch. It's about the Thai cave rescue from 2018, in which 12 football players and their coach were trapped deep in a flooded cave when monsoon season started early, and the elaborate rescue operation that ensued, which heavily relied on British cave divers. I was pretty sure I remembered this story having a happy ending when it actually happened, but even so, I was on the edge of my seat hearing all the details of this event and what a long shot it was to rescue these children. These middle-aged British guys who love cave diving as kind of a weird hobby suddenly find themselves the most qualified people in the world to save all these kids, and they not only do the diving, but they have to come up with most of the plan themselves. It's really remarkable. It's really inspiring, honestly. I have no idea how they captured all the footage they did in this one. There were cameramen side by side with the divers during some of the really intense moments on the day. It's truly remarkable. I absolutely recommend this film. It's a National Geographic film, so I think it will end up on Disney Plus before too long, and it's 100% worth your time. Those are a few of the films I saw through Hot Springs this year. I also watched several short films. You can see my mini reviews of all of those on Instagram. I have a story highlight for this year's Hot Springs Festival, so you can see all of that there. Really looking forward to next year's festival, and I hope I can make it in person next time.
My planet Arrakis is so beautiful when the sun is low. Rolling over the sands, you can see spice in the air. The outsiders ravage our lands in front of our eyes. Their cruelty to my people is all I've known. What's to become of our world?
Boy.
Duncan, can I trust you with something?
Yes, always, you know that.
I've been having dreams about a girl on Arrakis. I don't know what it means.
Dreams make good stories. But everything important happens when we're awake. Hey, you, put on some muscle?
I did?
No.
We are House Atreides. There is no call we do not answer. There is no faith that we betray.
Smile, Gurney.
I am smiling.
The Emperor asks us to bring peace to Arrakis. House Atreides accepts!
I know you. There's something awakening in my mind.
You need to face your fears.
Come with me. You need to be ready. I've never met Harkonnens before. They're not human, they're brutal.
The Duke's son sees too much.
This is Idun. Kill them all.
God in heaven.
Get everything with guns off the ground! Go!
This is an extermination. They're picking my family off one by one.
Let's fight like demons.
Dad, what if I'm not the future of House Atreides?
A great man doesn't seek to lead. He's called to it. But if your answer is no, you'll still be the only thing I ever needed you to be. My son.
If anything happens, will you protect Paul?
With my life.
Only together can we stand a chance.
And now let's talk Dune. This is one of the most highly anticipated films of 2021, starring Timothée Chalamet, Rebecca Ferguson, Zendaya, Oscar Isaac, Jason Momoa, Stellan Skarsgård, Josh Brolin, Javier Bardem, Dave Bautista, and even Chong Chin. So Chong Chin is the lead in the Wong Kar-wai film we're discussing in the second half of this episode, The Hand, and we've seen him recently in Happy Together, in 2046, basically he's all over the films of Wong Kar-wai, and I had no idea he was in Dune until I saw him on screen. It was a wonderful surprise, and that officially makes this the Chong Chin tribute episode of the podcast. So, Dune is a sci-fi epic based on the classic novel by Frank Herbert, and it hit theaters and HBO Max this past weekend. Our guest today to discuss Dune is none other than my very own wife, Allison Grigsby-Swetman. I love talking movies with her, and we actually don't have the opportunity to podcast together very often, so I was so glad when she said she'd sit down and talk about this one with me. Here is my conversation with Allison Grigsby-Swetman about Dune. I am thrilled to be joined by today's guest. She's a social worker, an advocate, a legislative editor, a law student, a dog lover, and she just happens to be my very own wife. It's Allison Grigsby-Sweatman. Welcome back to the show.
Hello. Back. I've been here before.
Yes. Been a long time. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. I'm very excited you're here. How are you today?
Here in this home that we share.
Yes.
I'm good. How are you?
Very good. I haven't recorded in person with someone in a long time.
Yeah.
Maybe since the last time we did it together. But yeah, you were on the podcast once before, way back in episode 2, I think, for Before Sunrise.
Before Sunrise. I remember very little about that movie.
It's a very romantic movie, so I was like, oh, I should have my wife on. This one is less romantic. We're going to talk about Dune.
For sure.
So I wanted to first say I planned to go see it, and how this all came to be was I was walking out the door to go to the movie theater to watch Dune, and as a joke, I said, hey, you know, you could watch this on HBO while I'm gone. And you did.
And I did. Surprising us all.
Surprising us all. So then I was like, you know what? I would love to have you back on the podcast. Let's talk about Dune. And so part of why I wanted to do this, I haven't talked about this on the podcast in a while, but part of what I think is important in film discussions is that we don't gatekeep in a way, or like decide whose opinions are valid and whose aren't. Like I used to say, movies are for everyone a lot. And I say that because you don't watch movies all that often, and you especially don't watch sci-fi movies all that often. I could have found someone who's really into sci-fi and has read all the Dune books to break this movie down, and that I'm sure would have been interesting and valuable, but equally valuable is the opinion of someone like you who's kind of a newbie to the world of Dune.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm also a newbie pretty much to the world of Dune, but I also probably have a lot of listeners who are Dune newbies, and so hearing your thoughts could really be helpful.
Yeah, I definitely do not watch very many movies just in general, which might surprise your listeners, but yeah.
There you go. Well, with that in mind, as someone who doesn't watch a lot of movies, doesn't watch a lot of sci-fi, what was it about Dune that made you say, hey, I'll check this out?
This is not an answer that has much to do with the movie at all.
That's fine.
I got home from class. I work full time and then I go to school after that. And so I got home around 9 p.m.
That's why she doesn't watch a lot of movies.
That's very busy. Part of why I don't watch a lot of movies. I got home around 9 p.m. and I don't know. It was the last class of my week. And I was for once feeling like, yeah, I could put a movie on. And earlier, like as I was leaving class, I talked to one of my classmates about how I needed to get home as soon as possible so that you could rush out and go to the movies because someone had to be here with the kids. And so I was like, I got to go home. My husband's going to Dune. And not one, but a few of my classmates said, oh, wow, so cool. You know, they were into it. And I don't know, piqued my interest. And of course, Timothée Chalamet.
It's got a lot of star power.
Yes, and Zendaya and Jason Momoa and Oscar Isaac. And I just was like, you know what? Why not? And I have sort of a 15-minute rule, and I definitely did for this. I was like, if 15 minutes in, I'm not feeling it, I'll turn it off. And you know, I just liked it after 15 minutes. Kept going
with it. That's great. Yeah, and I think that's probably going to be the case for a lot of people who aren't that into sci-fi because this is a buzzy movie, probably one of the most anticipated of the year.
Yeah,
it's got all these famous people in it, and we'll talk about those famous people. So first of all, did you like it overall? And then I'm curious, like when you think about the experience of watching Dune, is there one thing that sticks out, whether that's or that like pops into your head, whether that's like an aspect of the filmmaking or a theme of the film or a scene or a moment, an image, character, anything like that?
So I did like it overall, to answer the first question. Okay, a few things stick out to me, and they're not really what necessarily made me like the movie, but this is just kind of what stuck with me. So the main character, I guess, Paul, Timothée Chalamet's character, has this sort of chosen one theme, and that's like a theme throughout the whole movie. And that reminded me of Harry Potter and just kind of the, and some other like religious imagery and themes that I sort of grew up with. And I really liked that. That was familiar to me. I'm thinking about when he got off of that, I don't know, it's not an airplane, but an aircraft, yeah. And was sort of among the people, because he's royalty, basically, mm-hmm. and he was sort of among the people, and they were, like, yelling this word to him that basically meant chosen one,
yeah. mm-hmm.
and watching him sort that out, figure out what that means, and there's a lot of, like, prophecy that mm-hmm. was built into that, and the story unfolded really well, I think. Like, they told us just enough for that mm-hmm. moment to be like, oh, what's going on? And then later he has a moment where he seems to be fulfilling a prophecy mm-hmm. right before another character's very eyes. And that was interesting to me. I liked the way that that part of that world was presented throughout the movie, like the pacing of all of that. I also, as far as imagery goes, the dunes are just really majestic mm-hmm. and beautiful. There's a water likeness to the sand mm-hmm. in the movie that, I mean, I'm sure in nature, I know this is sci-fi, I know that it wasn't real, but I'm sure that in nature that exists too. And it made me think, I've never really wanted to go somewhere where there are actual literal sand dunes with, like, ripples in the sand and everything. But I was like, that would be really beautiful to visit someday. So that was gorgeous. And I think perhaps the most important thing that I took away, and that I hope a lot of people took away, is the way that class and privilege is shown, because there's this people group who are essentially royalty. They sort of function as royalty, and they're very much in the middle of things and in charge of things. And some of them become in charge of things early in the movie. And then there are these people who live on the margins. And the way that these two classes of people are talked about among one another is really, I think, almost allegorical. And also the relationship that those two groups of people have to the natural world is definitely, definitely, I think, instructive in the way that indigenous people relate to the natural world and have long before colonizers arrived on the land that they inhabited. And so, I don't know, just colonization, classism, privilege, all of those things, the way that colonizers tend to fear the natural world that they colonize and see it as something to conquer mm-hmm. And pillage. And then by contrast, those who have inhabited that place for generations, kind of the way that they live in harmony with it. And mm-hmm. I just thought that was done so very well. And I won't get into specifics because it might be kind of spoilery, but that was the biggest theme that I took away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really like all that. And so I was going to bring up something, I guess, related, which is sort of the critique of capitalism. Just mm-hmm. that we have, yeah, I think in Zendaya's first, she like has an opening monologue where she's explaining spice and all of that.
Right.
And she says something like, who are our next oppressors going to be?
Yes. They set it up from mm-hmm. the very beginning. Yeah.
And so, you know, and all the stuff you're saying about Timothée Chalamet too, and his like chosen one thing, he's almost like a Prince Hamlet figure a little bit.
Yeah.
And I actually have some more thoughts on that later on, but for me, the thing that like just sticks out the most is kind of the world building, and because like I literally had the thought, like the silly ridiculous thought during the movie, like, oh, I wonder if they actually filmed this on Earth. Like, of course. What? Like, but it feels like such a fully realized world that
yeah.
it feels really different. Mm-hmm. And there's some like visual similarities to this director, Denis Villeneuve's other films, Blade Runner 2049. You and I watched that. It's been a while.
I've seen that.
Yeah, we went to the theater. I don't know if you stayed awake the whole time. But just kind of like a haziness, a lot of fog and mist,
yeah.
and the sand plays into that.
Yeah.
But like there's some visual things there that are really good. But yeah, just like, so I don't know a ton about the history of this, but I know that Star Wars is very influenced by the Dune novel. And then I heard also that he wanted to kind of distance it from Star Wars in a way. And I think that was effective because mm-hmm. so much in Star Wars, you know, we have lightsabers and like blasters that have like laser bullets, right? Mm-hmm. But in this, everything is much more tactile and mechanical. And like there's a moment when like a very small drone essentially comes in to attack a mm-hmm. character but it looks like very mechanical and real world in a way that
it reminded me of a Tracker Jacker from
Hunger Games.
Yeah. That was the vibe. Yeah.
So I really like that about it. Yeah. I'm curious, do you have a favorite performance in the film?
I loved Rebecca Ferguson's performance. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've seen her in anything else.
Really?
Yeah. I was looking at her IMDb page and I'm not sure I have. Yeah, I thought she was phenomenal. I thought, and I'm also a mother, and I just thought that her maternal strength in several parts came through really beautifully in her acting job. And she's also just like really badass.
Yeah, like, she's very cool.
Yeah, she was really cool in it.
There's a scene pretty, I guess, fairly early where like she's outside of a room and her son is in the room and is in some amount of danger.
And pain.
And pain. And like her performance in that scene is really incredible.
It seemed like she could feel the pain too.
Yeah.
There was something that told me that she could feel the pain that her son was feeling in that moment, which is some like the kind of thing that parents say. I don't want to just say mothers because it's true of many parents.
Yeah, that's interesting. So like it's not a spoiler to say that she has some sort of powers.
Right.
That's set up pretty early on. So I wondered if it was just that, but you're right. Maybe it's just a parental connection with her.
I think it could be both.
Could be both. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say, as far as performances, I think everyone's really good. Rebecca Ferguson, absolutely incredible. This might be my favorite Timothée Chalamet performance. Mm. I was thinking about other things I've seen him in, and I think this role asked him to do a little more than some of his other things. Mm-hmm. So like, obviously he looks great. He's got a great face, but he also like goes through some anguish in this movie in ways that I don't know if I've really seen before from him. And I thought he did really well with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you say, kind of back on what you were saying about like comparing it to Star Wars, would you say that it's also just more mature, or maybe for a more mature audience than Star Wars is? That's how I feel.
Maybe so. Yeah. You know? Yeah. And so we're going to talk about some critiques in a minute, and I might have more to say then about this kind of thing. But yeah, I think that's probably a good way to say it.
Like, I think that most of Star Wars, even with all of its perilous moments, we could watch with our 7-year-old and it would be okay. Mm-hmm. But I do not feel that way about this movie. Yeah. The villain is so gross and scary.
Yeah.
And so I just, and not just that, I think there's just something about it that feels more mature.
Heavier in a way or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting to see, like, because you can really look at Star Wars, like, I've seen Star Wars a million times. So I was thinking, like, oh, this person reminds me of Jabba the Hutt. This planet obviously reminds me of Tatooine. Like so much that kind of, you can see how George Lucas took that and made it his own. And yeah, made a much more fun family kind of a story.
Well, and like the Emperor, like the whole, the way that the like villainous Empire, it's not called the Empire in Dune, but the way
they do talk about an Emperor though.
Yes, they do talk about an Emperor though. But like that... that felt the same to me. Like that felt like the Empire to me.
Yeah. Very interesting. Do you have any negative things to say about Dune?
I, as a person who doesn't watch a ton of film, don't have astute criticism, but I do think we needed more Zendaya. And like, I get with the story.
We always need more Zendaya.
Of course we always do. But I just... that might be the primary reason that I'm like, if there's not a second one, what was the point?
You're not alone in that feeling. Yeah.
Okay, good. I haven't done much reading about it.
Heard some other people like just complaining about how it ends so abruptly.
Oh, yeah. Know, it's like it ends at the beginning of a new journey, you know? And so it's just like, I kept checking. It was very late and I was sleepy, but I did finish it. And I kept checking how much more is left? Like, it feels like we've got a lot to do. Like, we kind of just got to this place where we are. And it was like, oh, 15 minutes. Wow. So, yes, more Zendaya. And I guess maybe that abrupt ending. Like, I think that even if there was a presumed next movie or, you know, a maybe next movie, that was maybe a little abrupt for me, but
So I, from what I understand as well, just from like reading articles about this, Zendaya is pretty much the main character of the second one. From what I understand about that, but yeah, she's very mysterious and kind of aloof because she's appearing in his dreams. It's like for the most of the movie, we have her monologue at the beginning, and then just like little flashes of her face as he's seeing her and different things. Yes. As far as any critiques that I have, I think, and I've noticed this with his other movies. So he also made the movie Arrival, which you remember that one with Amy Adams? Yes. So he's got a little bit of sci-fi track record going. But I think all three of those movies, Blade Runner and Arrival and this, there's like, there's certain emotional core that's not quite as strong as I wish it was, I think. Mm. Like I was invested in Timothée Chalamet's journey here, Paul. And like, I really love the scene early on where he's talking to his dad. I didn't mention Oscar Isaac, who is great in this, mostly just looks great in this. Like,
yeah, he does. His beard is perfect. It's in so it. Good. Oh yeah. He looked great.
There's a scene where they're talking in a graveyard, mm-hmm. like with his father's grave. And, Timothée Chalamet saying like, what if I don't want this power? Like, and just kind of the assumed upon role, like he's, you know, not in control of his life in a way. Like, that was really compelling. And I guess that's like a really major theme of the movie, but it's, I don't know. It's, I know that's going to be much more explored in the second one. Maybe that's my complaint with the ending, is that like, that doesn't get quite enough, I think, for me. And so for that reason, I was like, I was interested in what was happening, but there were certain emotional things that could have been more emotional for me, I think. Mm. Which brings me to my next point is, so I think this is going to draw comparisons, obviously, to Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, in a way, like just the fact that it's so epic and it's such a world and it's kind of mainstream in a way that hopefully like a lot of people see it. But then I thought about, I think one thing, I haven't read the novel, I haven't seen the other film adaptations of this, but I think there's clearly so much more to this world that they can't fit into one movie, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think they do a pretty good job explaining some of that. Like, we see Timothée Chalamet, he's like watching a projector learning about the history of this planet, and like, so that's filling us in on some of how this world works, but it still felt like it couldn't quite carry the weight of like all the mythology that it maybe needed to or something. Mm-hmm. Which makes me think this could have been a better series potentially, like if they had more time. I know, like, on the Hollywood side of that, could they have gotten enough money? Like, all of that. But mm-hmm. It made me think about, with, like, Game of Thrones. I'll not spoil Game of Thrones here, but there's something that happens with Ned Stark's character near the end of the first season. You know what I'm referencing?
Yes.
And I think...
Isn't it the second season? I'm sorry.
No, I'm pretty sure it's the first
one. Is it? Okay. Yeah. Wow. What a first season. Okay.
Yes, indeed. But there's like a, there's a big battle in the middle of this movie that like there's some major fallout from it. And I wish that I would have been hit as hard by that as I was by Ned Stark's moment. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, I think with more time to like know these characters, know this world, like that could have been a really major emotional thing.
Yeah.
And it, I just thought it was interesting, you know?
Well, can I tell you, back to the like, where it ended thing, mm-hmm. I think a great movie would have ended pretty soon after that, you know? Yeah, I
mean, make this a trilogy or something.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about it as you were talking, like, it's pretty long. It's 2.5 hours, yeah. And it would have been weird to have such an epic movie only be 1 hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I know what you mean. The mm-hmm. event that you're talking about felt like it could have been a really fantastic ending, you mm-hmm. know, if, and they could have just done more with it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Hmm. Okay, I've got just a few more thoughts about this movie, and that is, and mostly these are really good things. The music, I think, is fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's Hans Zimmer does the score. I'm not always the biggest Hans Zimmer fan. I don't like dislike his music, but I wouldn't say he's one of my favorite composers. But I thought like this is probably my favorite thing that I've heard from him. Like, he does a lot of Chris Nolan films and things, but yeah, the music here is really fantastic. I was listening back to some of it, and like there's moments when, so there's like, are they called witches? There's like a I can't remember, like some wise sage people.
Like the old woman?
Yeah. I thought they used the word witch at some point.
But she's like the witch to the emperor.
Right.
Or something like that.
Yeah, like, she's so like a spiritual,
they're not like on the margins.
Or something. You know, right.
But yeah, yeah.
The music whenever they're around is like, there's like this kind of rhythmic chanting that's like, yes. Is it scary? Is it beautiful?
Spooky, it's, for it's, sure.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I really like those pieces. And just the sound design in general, this is where I'm going to say, if you can safely go to the theater, do, because the sound, I saw it in, it wasn't IMAX. Like, a lot of these theater chains have like Diet IMAX or whatever. Like, they're sort of, it's not officially IMAX, but it's bigger and it's louder. And I was in that at the Regal Cinema, and like, I was just like, when the spaceships are landing, I'm just like shaking my body. So the sound, I thought the sound was really immersive, and that probably had to do with the world building and like just really getting lost in it, which I think is probably, again, like my favorite thing of this whole movie. It's just like having this incredibly realized world to kind of get lost in for a little bit.
So I want to talk about a couple of other performances. I didn't know where this would fit in our conversation, but okay, first of all, Jason Momoa, I thought he was really great, but there was one scene where I was like, his acting is not the best. For someone who doesn't really criticize film-related things, I was even kind of like, okay. However, overall, I loved his performance and I really like him a lot. And
he brings his own energy to whatever he's in,
I think. For sure. You know? And I kind of thought, oh no, Jason Momoa is going to be very Jason Momoa in this. Like he's going to, like, is this going to be Aquaman in this setting? Right. Which I've never seen Aquaman, but you get what I'm saying. And so that's not what happened. That's really not what happened. And he had one really moving and touching scene, and his relationship with Timothy Chalamet's character Paul is really, really great, and I really liked it. And then I also think we need to talk about how there is a character who is not kind of in the middle of things, but she is on hit show Bridgerton, Netflix hit show Bridgerton, the queen from Bridgerton, who her performance in Bridgerton was excellent. I don't know if you remember, Andrew, we watched it a long time ago, but she was phenomenal. And as soon as I saw her face on the screen, I was like, that's the queen. Like, and so I thought she was fantastic as well.
I really thought Javier Bardem was really good. He plays one of the Freemen, and he like I almost didn't recognize him until he started talking. Thought he was really good. Sharon Duncan Brewster plays, I can't remember her character's name, Dr. Light Kynes.
Excellent.
She's from Sex Education.
Yes.
We've seen her in that.
Yeah. She was phenomenal. Like, I loved her character so much. It was honestly, it was her character that gave us those glimpses into the way the Fremen view the natural world. Mm-hmm. And it was her, I'm trying not to spoil anything, because she was tasked with basically introducing Timothy Chalamet and his dad to the way that the dunes are, like the way of the natural world there. And so she did such a great job at that, I thought.
Yeah, I thought so too. She's really, like, really key to this movie and I think really good. Dave Bautista is really great in it. He just kind of, like, has the look they need, you know? He's one of, like, the evil aliens. I can't remember their house name.
Are they aliens?
I think they're, in a way, maybe everyone's an alien, right?
I didn't know. Think that like, anyone in this movie was an alien.
I guess I shouldn't use the word aliens. Also, David Desmalshin.
He's really good. He was so creepy.
Yeah, he was recently in the Suicide Squad as the polka dot man. Mm-hmm. he has a great, like, unusual face for looking kind of creepy. And I also have to mention Chang Chin, who has been all over these Wong Kar-wai movies. He's actually the lead in The Hand. And I didn't know he was in this until I saw him on screen. I was like, wait a minute, is that Chang Chin? Because I mean, the most recent thing I've seen him in is 20 years ago or something. And so I just didn't see him. Josh Brolin, I think, is good as kind of
right-hand man.
An obnoxiously aggressive kind of, almost like an uncle figure to Timothy Chalamet.
Yeah, I liked, you know, thinking about the contrast. You mentioned earlier Oscar Isaac plays Timothy Chalamet's dad and how their relationship, well, you didn't say this, but I think their relationship and Timothy's relationship with...
his mom?
No.
Jason Momoa?
With Jason Momoa really, like, breaks down a lot of toxic masculinity, like breaks through a lot of toxic masculinity that you would like expect from this kind of monarch sort of, you know? And then you've got this right-hand man, you know, like reminding us that someone's got to go to war, and like he was very obnoxious in that. But, you know, his role was important, I think.
Yeah. I want to say one more thing about... So you talked about the prophecy elements and how interesting that all is. And there's even moments where I think intentionally in like even the costume design, it's bringing kind of messianic things to mind, you know, because like he's sort of a Christ figure. And I think, I don't think that's a stretch to say like that, you know, people, like the Freemen are chanting his name. And it's interesting how subtle that's all done. Cause like that's, that happens and it doesn't dwell on it in a way. Like that must be a really significant thing for him to experience, but it, mm-hmm. we don't really get a whole lot of like his reaction to it, to the point that
you wanted more.
Not that I necessarily wanted more. I think that was probably done well. Like, I think they definitely didn't overdo it. Maybe they underdid mm-hmm. it a little for me, is I guess mm-hmm. what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's scenes later on where like, just in the way he's dressed, like he looks a little Jesus-y right now.
Oh, and yeah, I think, the white, I like, think linen that's
intentional.
Almost.
Yeah, and like yeah. that must be important, like intentionally calling to mind for the viewers, you know, sort mm-hmm. of some of that Christological connection. So, yeah. Anyway.
Well, and some of the prophecy stuff that is only touched on. I wanted mm-hmm. so much more of that. But whenever those witchy women...
I'm sure that's more in the book.
Oh, yeah, know? For sure. Yeah. Whenever those witchy women came in and were saying, like, you gave birth to a son, first of all, mm-hmm. like, and criticized her for giving birth to a son, and something about, like, a chosen one and, like, keep an eye on him and, like, he might be the one, and but there's another one out there, you know, or something. And it was just this whole like, ah, there's this whole world and yeah. this whole like metaphysical situation that yeah. I'm very interested
yeah.
in.
Yeah, and that's where I feel like maybe the film couldn't quite handle the weight of what a huge novel this obviously is to have all these different world building yeah. things. I mean, I think it does a good job at getting mm-hmm. a lot of it in there, but it just... Yeah, there's so many of those things that I was like, oh, I know there's more information there that I would love to know, but they don't yeah. have time to tell me right now. They just, right. I could feel the adaptation happening, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's so interesting because I saw a tweet earlier about basically someone saying something that I've heard you say, which is, or maybe your brother said this to me one time when we were talking about like, do you like the book or the movie better? And this whole like, you don't have to choose. They're two distinct art forms in and of themselves.
Yeah.
And you can enjoy different things about, you know, like, and of course it's normal to draw comparisons and to say things like, I think this should have made it into the movie, you mm-hmm. know, or we needed more of this element and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, like, I think Dune was very enjoyable
yeah.
having not read the book. And of course they have to do that. But I don't know. It's adaptations are really difficult yeah. and it's never going to get everything. And if honestly, it would probably be painful because these seem like very dense books. Had we read them, we would be like so mad.
Yeah, yeah, I'm actually glad I haven't
read. Yeah, maybe we will now. I won't. Not for a while.
Yeah, probably not. Well, that is Dune. Check it out in theaters or on HBO Max right now. Thank you so much to my wonderful wife, Allison, for being here. Always a treat to talk movies with you.
Yeah, I had fun.
Well, we'll have to have you back soon.
Yeah, you know where to find me.
Huge thanks again to Allison for coming on the show. And now it's time for our final World of Wong Kar-wai episode. Omaya Jones has been with us for this entire film marathon, and today we finish it up. First, we look at The Hand, a short film by Wong Kar-wai. Then we talk through some of Wong's other films that are not part of the Criterion box set that we've been watching. And then we finish up by talking through some of our favorite moments from this film series, favorite music, favorite breakup scene, saddest misconnection, etc. This was a lot of fun to record, and I'm sad that Omaya won't be around as much going forward, but I'm determined to have him for another marathon in the future. Omaya Jones, welcome back to the podcast once again. How are you today?
I'm doing well. I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad that we are... well, I guess it's bittersweet that we're finishing up the Wong Kar-wai set. Yeah, there's a part of me that wishes that it could go on forever, but another part of me is happy for the opportunity to move on to other things once we wrap this up.
Yeah, I was going to ask you later. Maybe we should do another filmmaker some months down the road or something like this.
I have an idea. I have an idea.
Do. All right, we'll save
yeah.
it.
Do you want me to, yeah,
in
okay.
our final
we'll
thoughts
pitch
here.
It later.
We'll talk about that. We are going to finish up the Wong Kar-wai talk, talking about The Hand, which is a short film that is kind of the last thing in the box set. But we also each watched as many other Wong Kar-wai things as we could. We're going to briefly touch on those, and we're going to talk about kind of some of our favorite things from the whole series, kind of a look back. But first, have you been watching anything else? What have you been watching lately?
I have watched a few different things lately, mostly rewatches. So I had some people over last weekend, and we watched The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover, I hadn't seen since I... so like the first time I saw it, I immediately started raving about it to a friend of mine, and then he organized a watch party that was bigger than I intended. And you, having seen this, know that it is a very divisive film.
It's pretty
and
intense,
so like yeah. The, yeah, the reactions were very, very divided, very strongly divided. And so this was the first time that I'd seen it since that. And I think it went over pretty well this time. For, you know, two of us, we'd already seen it, and the other two, it was a new experience, but I was struck by how affecting it still was. I also rewatched a film called Crossing Delancey, which is a 90s sort of rom-com. It's like a rom-com about a 30-something Jewish woman whose mother or grandmother, her, what does she call her? Her not Nana, but what's the word that they used to like refer to their
a Yiddish word for grandmother?
Yeah, something like that. And like so anyway, she's urging her to get married, and so she tries to set him up with the pickle man, is a guy who owns a pickle restaurant. But she is not sure if that's a relationship that she wants to pursue.
Oh, is it like Bubby or something like that?
Bubby, yes.
Yeah, the reason I thought of that is that ridiculously silly movie They Came Together.
Yes, I love that. I love that film.
That word is thrown around. I just thought anyway.
You know, I'll tell you what scene from that film that I reference often is the scene when she's on the date. And the guy says that he doesn't read fiction books and doesn't understand them because it's like, why would you write it if it's not true? And yeah, that comes up a lot.
Yeah, the way they all say the word fiction books over and over is so funny.
But then the last thing that I saw was recently was this film Friends with Money, which was written and directed by a woman named Nicole Holofcener. And it's a film that I like, and I like to revisit it from time to time, but she wrote 1/3 of The Last Duel, which I also thought was just like an interesting choice. Cause it doesn't seem that would be the kind of thing that she would write. But now what I realize is that I guess the film is this Russian one-like tale that's in 3 chapters. And she wrote 1 of 3chapters from the perspective of the woman. So I'm kind of curious to see that next.
Yes. I wasn't going to bring that up. I forgot that I watched The Last Duel and I really liked it. I have a few issues with it, but mostly I think it's really, really good. I'm sad that it did very poorly at the box office compared to with the new Halloween, which I haven't watched yet. But Last Duel is solid. Very good performances. The Rashomon thing works really well. I think my thoughts on it are a little spoilery, so maybe we can talk about it another time, but I do recommend it. It's a very good one. And I was not familiar with her work until looking at the credits on this, being like, I've heard of her. And anyway, well, that's cool. The other things I've been watching, I'm going to try to rewatch Edgar Wright's movies before Last Night in Soho. So I watched Shaun of the Dead again for the first time in a long time. Obviously holds up, so good, so funny, so creative, and like the way he kind of melds the rom-com and the horror comedy and all of that is so good. And then I watched a movie called Sinister. Have you seen Sinister?
I have not.
It's Scott Derrickson, who he actually directed Doctor Strange in the Marvel Universe, but he has another one coming up called The Black Phone. And Jason Blum said The Black Phone is the scariest movie he's ever produced. So there's some high praise from that. But Sinister was also very scary. It had been recommended from a few people, but it's got Ethan Hawke in it. And basically the plot is he's a true crime writer and he stumbles across a box of snuff films. And over the film, you see each of them. And it's really pretty scary. I read an interesting thing afterwards that they did a study at some point. Like the top 50 horror movies, they did a study where they measured people's heart rates while they're watching it to determine like what's the scariest, which who knows if that's like an accurate representation, but this was number one. So there you go. You got people's hearts pumping anyway. And it definitely did for me. I really liked it. I think that's it for me. I'm trying to watch some scary stuff for Halloween season.
I always tell myself I'm going to watch scary movies in Halloween, but I never seem to get around to it.
I think this coming week I'm going to try. There's a handful of classics I've never seen. So I watched the first Halloween recently for the first time. I've never seen like Nightmare on Elm Street or the Evil Dead movie. So there's some of those like, how have you never seen this kind of movies? I'm going to try to catch up with. But what I wanted to say about The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover, that movie is so strange. And I think it's, so when I was in, I studied abroad and had a film class in Liverpool, and we did a whole segment on Peter Greenaway, who I had never heard of before that. And this was the last movie of his that we watched. Have you seen any of his other movies?
I've seen The Draftsman's Contract, and I may have seen, I know I've seen some of his short films, and and I have a couple of on like DVD or Blu-ray that I haven't watched yet, like Pillow Book and Prospero's Books.
Yeah. I have only seen, so I've seen The Draftsman's Contract and one called Murder by Numbers. And then maybe one other, I can't remember. But then we watched The Thief last. Compared to those others, the others are all so bleak, and especially for me at that time in my life, pretty inaccessible. The Cook, The Thief came along, and I was like, oh wow, this is like the most exciting movie ever compared to these others. But yeah, I do think it's really good, and there's a lot of very interesting observations. I think I wrote an essay about it. Maybe if I can find that, I'll send it to you.
Ooh.
But I think it was a lot about the color in the film and stuff, because there's a lot of interesting colors, and just about how humans are basically animals. And Michael Gambon is so incredible in that. Oh my gosh, yeah. I'm just remembering.
Whenever I show that movie to people, I just say, like, that's one of the Dumbledores. And I just like, yes.
Like Dumbledore being a total a-hole to everyone. Yeah, man. Well, that is a good movie. Yes, listeners, not for everyone, but check it out if you're feeling up for something very unusual. All right.
I think it is for everyone, even if you, even if you don't like it. Yeah. You may not like it, but it's for you.
It has Helen Mirren in it as well. If that may be another selling point, she's like super young in it. Yeah, she's great. Well, all right. That's all I've been watching. So let's talk about The Hand.
Del silenzio, angolo vuoto, pagina senza parole, una lettera scritta sopra un viso di pietra e vapore.
All right, let's talk about The Hand. So this is a short film that is on the last disc of the Wong Kar-wai box set. It's actually a sort of a director's cut of something he made for another project. So there's a film called Eros, which has three directors, Wong Kar-wai, Steven Soderbergh, and Michelangelo Antonioni. And they each did a segment, and his is called The Hand. But what we get on the disc is actually an extended version. It adds 15 minutes or so of additional footage, and I really liked it. It's got Chang Chen, who I didn't realize, who we've seen in Happy Together and in 2046, and then it has Gong Li, who is also in 2046 as Su Lai Jin, or what was her alias, I'm forgetting, the Black Spider, something like that.
Yes.
Yeah,
she had the same name. Yeah, she had the same name as Maggie Chung's character.
Her real name was the same name as Maggie Chung's character in The Mood for Love. And she plays, so the here's a little letterboxed plot summary. Says, the film tells the tale of Zhang, a shy tailor's assistant enraptured by a mysterious client, Miss Hua. And so Chang Chen plays Zhang, and it opens when he's speaking with her, and it seems pretty clear that she's on her deathbed, like she's not going to live much longer. And she said, do you remember when we met? And it flashes back to him, very young, very nervous, tailor's assistant. He's not a real tailor yet. And they have a sexual encounter. And he's, again, like mortified and, very nervous, being young and inexperienced. But then over the film, it seems to go over many years. And they have a sort of on-again, off-again physical relationship over the years. And she also, I believe, is a prostitute. Is that correct? Was I understanding that correctly?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think, I know like Tony Raines is referred to these women sometimes as good time girls, which I guess is like sort of like the parlance that they use to describe them. But yeah, essentially like a call girl or a escort or something of that.
Yeah, I think that term good time girls was something about like in the 60s at that time. I think you would meet them in a club. And I think I read something about that at some point, I think more in reference to 2046.
Right. And in The Hand, there's a reference when she says she's going back to work and she talks about going back to the club.
Ah, yes, yes. Yeah, so it's not made exactly plain, I guess. So I was not sure if I was picking it up correctly. But yeah, so that's kind of the basic plot. She has other lovers, and he is kind of on the sidelines for a lot of that. But you can tell they mean a lot to each other. And that's kind of the setup of it. And we'll talk about maybe the ending in a minute here. But so do you know much about the production of this other than sort of the construction of, you know, being part of Eros, and was it, where was it made before 2046?
I don't know a ton. I know it was filmed in 2003. And originally, I guess Pedro Almodovar was supposed to direct a segment. He dropped out. And I think Steven Soderbergh replaced him. So that I think is sort of interesting or noteworthy, but they're originally supposed to shoot in Shanghai, but because of the SARS outbreak, their permit was revoked and they shot in Hong Kong. And a lot of the crew apparently quit because they didn't want to risk the contagion. And so like that directly affected the production of the film. Oh, this is a good quote. It says, to speed up production, the last 2 days of shooting were done in a 48-hour period of continuous work. Quote, "It was a nightmare, but this situation inspired me to make a film about the sense of touch," declared the director during the press conference in Venice.
Very interesting. Oh yeah, and I was going to note just in the Steven Soderbergh segment of Eros, which is called Equilibrium, Robert Downey Jr. is in it and Alan Arkin. And I guess I should have mentioned like the whole theme of Eros, if these are stories about love and sex. So obviously The Hand, that seems to go along with Wong Kar-wai's filmography in a way, so I can see why they wanted him for this. But I guess that's probably enough on the production. Let's talk about kind of our reactions to it. I thought that the theme of The Hand is kind of used really well, like their hands, not only in sexual situations, but in cooking, and he's a tailor, so he's caressing these dresses at different times. There's just like a lot of hand imagery in the film. What did you think of the film overall?
Oh, I was really taken by it enough that I watched it again before we started recording. So Eros is streaming on Canopy. So I watched that cut of the film to see if I noticed anything different.
Interesting.
And so there's like, you know, the version on the disc has like 13 minutes of additional footage, but just like the beauty of it, the stillness of the camera work. I like the simplicity. I think Wong Kar-wai really shines when he's focused on a few characters. And so in here, we really only have two that are doing most of the heavy lifting. Especially like the scene. So, you know, in the opening scene when she asks if he remembers the first time that he met her or when they first met, and then it flashes back and we see sort of how, you know, their first encounter, which also involved the hand, but she's talking about how, like, you know, if you've never touched a woman, how can you, you know, be a tailor, right? And so like there's that scene towards the end when sort of like, you know, she's sick, but he sort of does the measurements but without like the tape. He just kind of feels her, you know, and he's touching her, and it's very sensual and sort of romantic, and I was really taken by that. I also like the subtlety. Like, there's a lot upon the second watch, there's a lot that I didn't notice the first time, so I think it rewards rewatching things that I didn't quite pick up on, or wasn't paying as close attention to as I should have, but the second time was really enlightening.
Yeah, that's really cool. That makes me want to watch it again. But yeah, I thought, and I just thought about, like, I'm curious about the other segments of Eros, and sort of, you know, if you're tasked with make a short film about love and sex, like, I don't know. It seems like he kind of came at it at a little bit of an interesting angle, because you don't think about hands as part of eroticism that often, but obviously they are a big part of that, and so focusing on her hand specifically in those sex scenes and what she's doing is an interesting thing. But yeah, like I mentioned, there's other hand things, like my favorite thing I think in the whole film is when She tells her her maid or whoever lives with her to or works for her to send him with some of these dumplings, and it's like some sort of rice dumplings wrapped up in leaves. And there's this scene where he's eating it, and like, and it cuts to her putting it together, like cooking it, like so lovingly, like using her hands, and you can't even see her face. I don't think it's just her hands putting it together, and like almost caressing it and like putting it together with love, and then him enjoying it, and like there's like a connection you can feel, like he can almost like, you can't actually, I wasn't even sure if he was imagining her hands creating it or if that was in his head or if that was a real flashback, but like that that connection through food. And then a sort of a parallel thing where he's at one point ironing one of her dresses and like really caresses it, but it's just flat on an ironing board, but his hands on the dress, which I think you were referencing. But yeah, I thought it was good. I thought also he looks like Tony Leung in 2046. He's got his suit.
Yeah, I was gonna say the mustache just makes a reappearance on a different face, but it's like the same thing.
But yeah, so those are some of my basic thoughts on anything else about the hand. We should talk about the ending, maybe. We want to go spoiler.
Yeah, the controversial ending, or I guess the is it controversial? Yeah,
earlier I said, well, it's kind of a swing. I think. So basically, there's a hand job at the beginning of the film, and then again at the end, and but it's done in a very like sensual, sexy sort of a way, and I guess the thing that's unique in that final scene is like she's kind of on her deathbed, right, and reconnects with him in this way, and so I definitely like raised an eyebrow. I was like, oh, is she gonna do this even though she's sick and dying? Interesting. All right. But I did think it worked. I thought it was really tender and sweet even, and but yeah, I read some reaction to it saying it was like the most unintentionally funny ending of a Wong Kar-wai movie or something, and I was like, I don't think so.
But I just feel like the person who wrote that is probably like, I don't know, 17 and has not experienced anything. But you know, but like, I mean, to me, it's just interesting. Like, you have these two characters that are just sort of on different trajectories, right? So, like, when the film starts, she's like a high-priced call girl escort, and then, of course, over the course of the film, we see her decline as she loses her most profitable clients. The way I interpreted it was that she was impregnated and then had an abortion.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Right, I wonder if it had something to do with her work, but I wasn't clear on what it was. Yeah.
Well, so you know, first you see there's a scene where her lover is leaving their apartment and there's just a close-up on her belly, and then she's being measured and you see that she's gaining weight,
interesting,
the measuring tape, and then she goes away for a while. Like she says she's going to Europe or something, right? But to me, I thought the implication was that she was going to have an abortion and she leaves her apartment.
That makes a lot of sense.
Well, I mean, like my timeline might be off because I can't remember like when she actually leaves and when she comes back. Because there's also a point where she says that it's been several years since she's seen the Taylor character.
It's like 2 years since they've even talked on the phone or something at some point. I was surprised by that much passage of time. But yeah, I wondered if maybe she had contracted some sexually transmitted disease or something like that. But
By the end of the film, I think that is certainly what happens.
You think that's what it is? Okay.
Or maybe even pneumonia. I don't know, because you know, there's a scene where he goes to find her and it's raining, and you know, she's out, she's working in the rain. So it could be some sort of STD, or it could be some other illness that just came with the lifestyle. Because
she starts with a hazard of the job kind of thing.
Right, like her living situation by the end of the film is, you know, she's living in a rundown hotel somewhere, who knows. Meanwhile, like, just based on his clothing, we see the way he starts out as an apprentice, and by the end of the film he's wearing these nicely tailored suits and everything.
Well, yeah, I really liked it. I did the ending again worked for me. I thought it was solid and kind of a good ending. It's, you know, it's sort of something quintessentially Wong Kar-wai about it, maybe, that's like, you know, it's short, it's condensed, but it has, you know, these elements of time, and it has sort of this longing and these misconnections and all those things in this kind of short little package. And it's got Chang Chin and it's got Gong Li, so some actors we've seen in other things of his. So yeah, I liked it. I definitely recommend The Hand. Well, let's move on and talk about other Wong Kar Wai things. So we've mentioned before, but you know, I wasn't totally clear on when I first heard, oh, they're making a box set, like what films are included. Is it all of his films? It's not. There's a few that are outside of that. So other features, which again, we've talked about these in previous episodes, but is there anything I'm missing out outside of Ashes of Time, The Grandmaster, and My Blueberry Nights as far as feature films?
No, I think that's all of the features. I'm excited. There's a project coming up, but I know very little about it, you know, called Blossom Shanghai, or I think is what it's called.
Yeah, it's a TV thing,
but
right?
I think that, yeah, so that there should be many hours of Wong Kar-wai footage in the future that we can see.
Have you seen any of those three features that I just mentioned?
So I have seen, it's been a long time, so I don't remember the details, but I have seen, I think, all of them. I've seen the American cut of the Grandmaster. I have not seen, there's like an extended Hong Kong cut, but apparently it's not just that the American version is shorter. There's also different footage used in both. And so my understanding that it's worth it to seek out both versions just because there's different material. I've seen My Blueberry Nights. I think something gets lost in the translation. It's only English language film. And then, yeah, Ashes of Time I watched while we were, before we did Chungking Express, but I will be honest and transparent. I did fall asleep during a portion of it, so I don't quite count it.
All right.
Yeah. Also, it's like a bad DVD copy. I want like a good proper restoration of that.
Yeah, which apparently like some of the footage has been lost and that kind of thing from what I remember. There is a Blu-ray available. I don't know if it looks any good, but I've been thinking I might pick that up at some point just to be a Wong Kar-wai completist. So I have not seen any of those other features, but I did, in preparation for this, find as many of his shorts that I could, because he has several things. a lot of them are advertisements for TV, some music videos, that kind of thing. So I thought I might talk through briefly some of the others that I've seen. One is on the set. I went back and watched, the Chinese title Hua and De Nian Hua, which is the one about, it's just archival footage of old Chinese films that had kind of been restored and cut together into a little tribute video, which I thought was pretty cool. And it looks good. It definitely does make you feel like there's some gems, some films out there that like each little piece, like that looks like a really interesting movie. And so I thought that was a cool project.
But they're lost with, right?
I think that's it. Yeah.
Clips from like old nitrate films that are probably destroyed in fires. And those are like the surviving pieces of them.
Yeah.
So I think that fits thematically. Well, I don't know. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe they some of them exist more in more complete form, but I feel like it fits with the themes that he
comes
back
kind
to
of lost connections and those types of things. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think about the ending of In the Mood for Love and sort of the ruins and looking back at previous things. Yeah, that definitely fits with that. Here's fragments of things that are no longer existing, like you're saying. So I saw that one. I think this is roughly in chronological order. This first one has a very long title. It's WKW/TK/1996 at 7. It looks like 7 foot, 55 inches, but I think it means 7 minutes, 55 seconds, HK.net. And that's all one kind of, it looks almost like a URL or something. To translate that, it's Wong Kar-wai. And then TK, hold on, I'm forgetting TK's full name here.
But he's like a fashion designer or something.
Yeah, I think that's right. And then 1996 is when it was made. 7 minutes, 55 seconds is when it, or how long it is, the length of it. And then HK.net. So it was made in Hong Kong. His name is
Takeo Kikuchi.
Yes. And he is a fashion designer. So it's kind of like, you know, what if Ralph Lauren teamed with, you know, a filmmaker to create a little short film or something. That's kind of how I thought about it. And it kind of could feel maybe like a fashion ad or something, but the only available copy that I could find, and I think that's available at all, is very, very blurry copy on YouTube, which I can link to in the show notes. But it's, you know, it kind of feels like a Wong Kar-wai film. It's kind of things jumping around. Definitely had some sort of Chungking Express feeling to it, maybe a little bit. But I think the story is that there's a Chinese woman and a Japanese man in a relationship, and maybe it's a contentious relationship. It's kind of hard to tell, but like they have guns and they're shooting each other and they seem like they're dying, but then they're back in the next scene. And so it's just kind of free form and all over the place. The camera's very kinetic and moving all over. Frenetic even is probably a word I would use. Like she sets fire to their bedroom at one point, and there's this kind of like cool blues music playing. So it's an unusual little short. It's so blurry that you can't really read the subtitles, so I wasn't sure what they were saying. But at the one point I read somewhere that it was Chinese and Japanese relationship, and I think that he is the Japanese character because he plays with like a, looks like a Mr. Spell or something, like a little kid's toy that's teaching him basic Chinese phrases. It's like xixia and so it's a, I think he was sort of trying to learn his Chinese there. But yeah, so it's interesting little short. Were you able to watch that one?
I did watch that. If depending on how much you want to invest in watching what is potential being the keyword there, a better version of this film, if you have a Laserdisc player and you are willing to find the Fallen Angels Laserdisc, I believe it is a supplement on that. So
I saw some mention of that. I don't know if the Fallen Angels Laserdisc is available at all anywhere either. Or is that?
Well, it's a Japanese Laserdisc, so that adds a layer of difficulty to your quest.
If anyone finds that, please tell us, because I would love to know about it, the process of getting that. So yeah, that's an interesting one. The next one I found was a Motorola commercial. What's interesting about this one is it stars Faye Wong. Again, a very blurry copy is on YouTube. It's hard to tell exactly what's going on because it's so blurry, but it seems like there's a couple calling each other on the phone, and eventually they get together kind of over the course of this 3 minutes or something. Did you watch this one?
I don't know. What is it called?
I just think I looked up Motorola commercial, Wong Kar Wai, and found it on YouTube.
You know, I saw, I did watch a Scotch commercial, but I don't think I've seen that one.
Yes, I'm coming up on the Scotch one in a minute. Yeah, okay. I really did some digging here. So the Motorola commercial is pretty, you know, again, it's so blurry, you can't really tell what's going on. But the one funny thing is, so it's got Faye Wong and at the beginning and then throughout it, she's saying hello in different languages on the phone. And it's like, again, it's also very frenetic and it's like cutting between different things of her, but she's like ni hao, hello, and then the thing that really made me laugh was she does like a big obnoxious Australian good day mate on the phone. That's pretty funny. So that one is on YouTube also. I'll link to that. Next one I found, so it's a French title, but it's a French commercial from 2000, the year 2000, that has 12 different directors. Oh, and the translation is One Morning All Over the World. It's the French company is JC Deco, I believe is how you say it. I don't know much French, but did you watch this one?
No.
It's like 5 minutes long or something. So each of these 12 directors is directing like 5 seconds. You know, it's really, really short, but it's supposed to be like a morning in Hong Kong is a Wong Kar Wai thing. And then it's got David Lynch, Spike Lee, Francis Ford Coppola, Wim Wenders, Roy Anderson, like a bunch of different people that I at least have heard of. And yeah, so like the Wong Kar Wai segment is like at a train station and there's an advertisement that's kind of striking, and then there's like a person sitting there, and I can't even remember what they're doing, but it's really brief. But I was like, oh, that's cool, it feels like Wong Kar Wai compared to these other segments. So that's also on YouTube. Next one I think you have seen, it's the BMW. So they had like a series called The Hire, and the segment that Wong Kar Wai did is called The Follow. So I haven't watched the whole series, I've just seen his segment, but it has Clive Owen in it, and he's following Adriana Lima at the behest of her husband, who's played by Mickey Rourke, and I think his agent is Forrest Whitaker. So some big names in this one, and Clive Owen, it's mostly him driving around in his BMW looking cool and kind of narrating about life. I don't know, it feels like a Wong Kar Wai-ish the way it's just like a lot of narration and stuff. But yeah, what do you think about this one?
I have a soft spot in my heart for these. I think this came up in an earlier podcast, but when I was in high school, when we found out that there was these BMW DVDs or these short films that they commissioned from different directors, that you got if you test drove a BMW, we went to the you know, BMW dealership, and you know, we were just like, hey, you're not gonna let us test drive this car, but just get this DVD. And they did, you know.
Nice.
So yeah, like the,
how
the
many
higher
people around here really cared about this, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Seen, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I still have the DVD of the first series. I don't know if I ever got the disc for the second series, but when they came out, they were all online at the time, although I'm sure they were not in like HD or whatever. But yeah, the higher series is neat also because like the directors involved, you know, this like Ang Lee, Wong Kar-wai, Guy Ritchie did one. And so, you know, there's just an immense level of talent in those things.
Yeah. And so the story like flows together because what I saw was really
well. Just Clive Owen plays the driver in all of them, right? Oh, okay. So it's not like it's not one story. Yeah, it's like different shorts with just that feature this one character who showcases the capabilities of the BMW.
Hmm. Yes, yeah. So in this one, it seemed like he was tailing her, and then he kind of like maybe fell in love with her. It wasn't clear, and then he lets her go, and he says he lost her. But it did make me think of. I mean, another Wong Kar-wai feeling thing is that she falls asleep at a bar, which we've seen happen in a few films with Chungking Express. And maybe someone doesn't fall asleep, but there's a bar in Fallen Angels quite a bit. Anyway, so that was pretty cool. Any other thoughts on that one?
No, they're all on YouTube. People should check out the series.
Maybe I can find the rest of them. That's cool. I didn't know such big names are involved. And yeah, there's a few different, because I watched one that was like not great looking and then 5 minutes later found one that looked a lot better. So I'll find the best one I can and link it. The next thing I watched was a music video for 6 Days by DJ Shadow. Have you seen that?
That sounds familiar. I'm going to say no.
I mostly went through IMDb and then Googled, can I watch this title, copy paste. And so this one, it's a song I'd heard before. I wouldn't have been able to tell the title, but it's and actually I think I've heard it remixed in different things. Actually, you know what? It was remixed in Too Fast, Too Furious. Or no, Tokyo Drift, the third one. And for some reason, my brother was obsessed with that movie when he was in high school. He was like the right age to see that, and he had the soundtrack. And so I had heard that song a few times. But again, that's like some rapper remixing that. But it definitely has some Wong Kar-wai feeling things. There's several clocks. The time 4:26, like the numbers 4:26 are repeated, which is kind of 2046 feeling a little bit. And it's mostly like this couple making out and like being sexy. That's pretty much the whole thing. And there's a Bruce Lee quote at the end of it, which is kind of interesting.
So you know, I'm actually watching it right now. And I think there's clips from, it looks like there's like, potentially a clip from Ashes of Time in here.
Really?
Yeah. Well, there's a part where a guy peers through a hole in a wall or something. And I was like, is that from the movie? I don't know. Or maybe it's all from 2046. I don't know.
Yeah. That one's on YouTube as well. I'll link that one. Next thing I watched was a Lacoste commercial by Wong Kar-wai. It's very short. It's like a minute, maybe a minute and a half. And it's basically just two models wearing Lacoste shirts looking at each other. Like I didn't really feel very like Wong Kar-wai-ish necessarily to me. But it was kind of cool. I'm glad I watched it. Next one was the Dior. I think there's a couple Dior things. I can only find one of them. This one's called Midnight Poison. It's a commercial where, you know, and I was thinking like before getting to this perfume ad, that a lot of these previous things kind of feel like perfume ads, like the way that, I mean, among advertisements that I see, perfume ads are tend to be the most like, I don't know, out there. Maybe like, it's like, what is this a commercial for? Oh, it's perfume or it's a cologne thing. But this has Eva Green in it and she's running around in a dress. She wears like she's like some sort of masquerade, like an Eyes Wide Shut kind of a thing. But I don't know. She like swings on the chandelier, and there's a Muse song playing throughout the whole thing. So there's that. And it's really short also.
Yeah. I feel like the aesthetics, like perfume ads in the '90s, I feel like just took a lot of their aesthetics from art house films. But I just feel like that's like, I feel like that was also like a trope or like a thing that was made fun of. Like I keep thinking of the show, The Critic. And I feel like that was like a thing, like was a recurring thing in that on that show.
I've not seen that show.
Oh. You should. Yeah. Sure. You never. It's an animated show that ran for like 2 seasons where John Lovitz played a Siskel and Ebert style film critic.
Huh. That sounds very interesting. I never even heard of that. Wow. Well, the next thing I watched was, it's called I Traveled 9,000 Kilometers to Give It to You. Have you seen this? Do you know what this is?
I think I started that. Is that, that's the one, it's the movie theater. There's like some fruit.
Yes.
Right. Yes.
Yes, exactly. That one. Yeah. So what this is a segment again from something with several directors, 34 different directors. This played in Cannes in 2007. The overall project is called To Each His Own Cinema. And so I think it's sort of each of these directors makes a short that's sort of about going to the theater or like something about cinema, like the art form of cinema. And in this one, it's like he's eating fruit and then he sort of, it seems like he's having a flashback and remembering another time he was in a movie theater and had like a sexual encounter with someone. And so he's like eating his fruit and thinking about that, watching a movie in the movie theater. And that's basically it. It's like, I can't remember how long, like less than 10 minutes. Oh, 3 minutes. So it's 3 minutes long.
Yeah. So yes, it's very, very short.
Yeah. Also on YouTube. The next one I watched is There's Only One Sun. And I know you did watch this one because we talked about it briefly. This is a Philips advertisement, but it's pretty interesting. Tell us about this one, Omaya.
I can pull up the context that I sent you earlier, because that's about all I know. I will say in general, it seems like a lot of the way Wong Kar-wai pays the bills or I guess shooting these advertisements for different entities in between features and probably during the filming of features because of the prolonged shooting schedules that his films typically have. But so this is from Philip's website. It says director Wong Kar-wai reprises the futuristic mood from his feature films and weaves a lush spy story to advertise Philip's Aria LCD technology for DDB Amsterdam. Digital domain used 2D and compositing technologies to enhance the beauty of this piece, including all light special effects seen on and around Agent 006. The backgrounds and surrounding environments are mostly digital set extensions, and even the window shapes and interiors of the car were altered by digital domain to more exactly match the director's vision. And so I wonder if this was sort of like I don't know when this was released in connection with the 2046, but I wonder, like, I'm assuming, or I wonder if like the people who did the effects for this were the same that did the effects for 2046, and if there was a connection there in terms of financing and also just seeing how it would work out and to what extent that you could get away with using
these digital effects. Digital things. Then post kind of thing. Yeah. So I think it came out in 2007, which is would be close to 2046. But yeah, definitely has that same kind of sci-fi feeling. She's so it's like a spy, like 006. And we found out at the very beginning, she's blind. And there's a lot of talk about light and dark. And it's sort of like very heady, philosophical kind of sounding thing. And she's gone blind because she saw something too bright. And like the name of her handler, I think his name Light.
Yeah.
And she kills him at the end before he can kill her. And that's kind of it. But I think probably the most striking thing is there's like a hallway that she walks down and like looks at something at the end of it. And the lighting of it is really, and like the whole set design of it is really interesting. It almost looks like it organic in a way. Like I wonder, like it's supposed to be like a spinal cord or like a retina or something. I guess maybe that would make sense. I don't know. But like it's there's some visually striking stuff in that one as well. So that is There's Only One Sun. Next up, the two more perfume commercials for Lancome. Lancome Hypnose perfume for him and for her. And there's two different like similar ads. There's not much to these. There's kind of silky looking background and like people looking handsome and pretty, and it's Clive Owen is the man in the for him one. So that's really the only interesting thing there. They're like 30 seconds long. Next up, Mask, which is another perfume commercial. I think it's perfume, or it's like for it's a makeup company called Shu Aerom. I can't speak French. Oh my gosh. Shu Aerom Emura. I don't know. It's really basic short commercial. Again, I don't really have any other thoughts on it, but it's on YouTube. And then the one you mentioned earlier, which is for like a whiskey, is called Deja Vu. For the whiskey's called Shiva 25. It's like a 25-year-old aged whiskey. And this is kind of cool. It's in two parts. It has Changchun, probably the most interesting thing there. And so he's like the male lead, and he's, you know, in his suits looking really handsome. And then Du Juan, who is a supermodel who I wasn't familiar with, but part one and part two, they meet and kind of miss their connection. And of course, there's a Wong Kar-wai thing. And then in part two, they get back together. So that's basically it. Any other thoughts on that one? Did you watch that one?
The Scotch commercial. I mean,
yeah.
Or no, we're on the Dior, or I don't
know. The Scotch one.
Oh yeah. You know, they were so quick. I watched them very quickly. I did not think about them very much after that. Like, it's like a two-part thing, you know, and it's kind of like,
yeah.
Like, I remember I was surprised when there's a part that's in English. I was like, oh, okay. Like,
yeah, lot. I think the second part's in New York or something, but it's like it's snowing. It's like the first time it snowed in 25 years, which that somehow feels kind of Wong Kar-wai-ish too. So just funny little things like that. And they're like 2 minutes each, so they're really short. But apparently they played at Cannes or something. Like, they opened up some other screening. That's kind of fun. And then the very last thing that I found is a thing he made for the Lunar New Year. This is a short for Mercedes-Benz, which is another car commercial. It's only in Chinese, and so there were no English subtitles, so I wasn't sure what was going on, but felt very heartwarming. It's a lot of families, you know, reconnecting. It's like, it's kind of long. It's like 6 minutes or something as far as commercials go. And it definitely felt like, and Lunar New Year is an interesting thing, like having lived in China for a little while. It very much is the way we, like, everything feels different at Christmas time because of decorations and the music and all that kind of, there's a whole culture around that every year. That's kind of how Lunar New Year is. And so it kind of captures that a little bit. So I felt a little familiarity from my China days that watching that. That's all the things I watched, but I did find out about another thing, which is called 1/10 of a Millimeter Apart, which is a documentary, 30-year anniversary documentary that, and it wasn't clear. I found there's an IndieWire article about it. It played whenever Happy Together was like restored and played in some theaters. This played like before it. And I'll link to the IndieWire article because it has some interesting information. I don't think it's like available anywhere, but it's like I think it's pretty short, like maybe 30 minutes. And it's sort of a retrospective on all of his films, which is interesting. But that seemed like a good thing to put on a Criterion disc, but I guess they didn't. But I mean, that title, 1/10 of a Millimeter Apart, is referencing the narration in Chungking Express when they, you know, they freeze frame and they're right next to each other. Anyway, that's all my things as far as other Wong Kar-wai projects. So
I did some digging. Yeah, there's a trailer for that 1/10 of a Millimeter Apart.
Yes, and I've seen the trailer. Yeah, I watched the trailer. But yeah, it's kind of, it seemed like there's no plans for it to do anything else other than play that one time, which is kind of sad, but because it looked like it could be a good little overview kind of thing, even to show someone like, why is this guy a big deal? Wong Kar-wai, here's like a little pretty quick thing. You could kind of understand him a little bit. Anyway, that was another interesting thing I came across, but yeah, so he's done a lot of commercial work, a lot of little things. And, you know, that fits in a way because, you know, he has such a mood, kind of a vibe, I guess, in his films, and to package that in a little thing to sell something kind of makes sense. So anyway, that's all my other Wong Kar-wai projects that I had. Do you have any other things you've seen that he's worked on?
No, not any, you know, I haven't seen most of the shorts. You know, I was kind of going off of like the Letterboxd thing.
Yeah. And there's less of those. Like, a few of those are on Letterboxd, but that's about it.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like, it's a sort of a crutch, but I feel like if I can't log it, then what's the point? So
I run into that sometimes at film festivals when I'm watching short films, and it's like, this is a brand new filmmaker. I can't log this. This feels sad because then it's like I'm not even counting it in my annual count. But anyway, well, then I thought we might kind of wrap this whole thing up. This whole Wong Kar-wai marathon by talking about some of our best of moments of the marathon. And I'm kind of stealing this idea from the Film Spotting podcast because they do this, but they have a little bit more involved with how they do it. But I just thought we'd talk through a few of our kind of favorite things here. We can do best song or like musical moment, favorite breakup scene, saddest misconnection, because there's so many misconnections, favorite performance, and then best film. So I'm going to have like a couple like, oh, I almost chose this, but yeah. I ended up going with this one on all of these. But yeah, you ready to move into that?
Yeah, let's do it.
So first up, music is such an important part of all of his films, and I thought it would be fitting to talk about that as we kind of wrap up. But looking back, is there like one musical moment that sticks out the most?
Yeah, I think the one that I keep coming back to in my head is the end of Days of Being Wild, where Tony Leung is just preening in, you know, the mirror and getting ready to go out, and there's just music playing, and I can, it's either like Xavier Cugat, who was like this band leader in the 40s or 50s. Yeah, I think that's what it is, because I bought a CD of his.
Nice.
His music, because I was like, I gotta hear more of this stuff.
Yeah, for most of these, I've actually found an Apple Music playlist that's got like, for each of the films, there's like five or six songs in most of them. So that I kind of was looking back through those to choose this, because all of these I can look at the movie poster and like remember the music in it. You know, that's kind of how I feel about it. So like I almost went with Yumeji's theme from In the Mood for Love that plays over and over in the slow motion. It's so good. Like honestly, when I think of just Wong Kar-wai in general, like that song almost just starts playing in my head. But I really like In Days of Being Wild. There's, I think it's called Perfidia. That may be the one you're talking about.
Oh yeah, that's the one I'm talking about. Yes.
It also recurs in 2046 when there's kind of that connection.
Yes. And I made sure like that is the track that I was like, okay, I'm going to buy one of these albums, but it's going to have that song on it. I thought you were going to say Take My Breath Away.
That's my one. So I almost like have one listed for you. Says I thought about doing Take My Breath Away, because I've been listening to that version of it a lot from As Tears Go By. That's like the first, it's like a literal needle drop, because you watch the needle drop onto the record. And then I think it's like the most music video feeling probably piece in all of these films. But then I also thought about in Happy Together, the Cuckoo Cuckoo, if I can say it, Cuckoo Cuckoo Paloma. I think I said that too.
You know what? That would be like my, if I had to pick another one, like that would be that, just because that to me is like the first time in the set where I felt like that, just like the use of that over the waterfalls, sort of like abstracted and disconnected from the rest of the narrative, to me is like such a strong and evocative image. And if I didn't pick it, it's only because I also, like before I had seen Happy Together, I had seen Talk to Her by Pedro Almodovar. And just have like, maybe have like a stronger connection with that. And then also while we were doing this, I watched the 5-year engagement. And so maybe there's also some of that is in there too.
Yeah. Cause so both of those films use that. Yeah. You remember you talking about 5-year engagement. It's sort of a silly version of it.
Yeah.
So yes, all of those are so good. But the one that I ultimately think is the one like that I have been listening to the most, like that I'm streaming, is the Fei Wong version of Dreams from Chungking Express. So that is my choice. I know I talked about each of these movies, but that song is so good. Obviously in that movie, you also have California Dreaming over and over and over, but that's, I don't know. Like, I don't want to just go listen to that song, I guess, that often, but the Dreams I think is really good. It's the cover version, but so that is my musical scene. But yeah, that Take My Breath Away from As Tears Go By is so good too. Anyway, so many good songs. So the next thing I thought we'd talk about is breakup scenes. There's some pretty memorable breakup scenes. Did you have one that was your favorite?
Yeah, so I'm going to interpret breakup pretty liberally here.
Okay.
I'm going to go with, I would have two. All they both involve, it's like I break up because somebody dies. Okay. And the first would be the ending of As Tears Go By. Right. Just because as that character is laying there dying, there's like this quick flash to Maggie Cheung. And it's just like the way that is represented on screen. And then the other would be Yeti's surmise at the end of Days of Being Wild, even though like he'd already broken up at that point with like both of those women, but
yeah, it's a final nail in the coffin, so to speak. Yeah. Yeah, those are good. That's good choices. I have a Yeti thing on the next category, but for me, my runner up, I guess, for breakup scene would be in Fallen Angels. It takes place in the lobby of her hotel. It's like, you know, there's stairs down and you're in the street and there's like this neon lighting. And I don't know, I thought it was really striking. I don't remember the characters' names right now, which is terrible, but she becomes physical and like starts hitting him and stuff. That like mixed with the visual of that, I thought that was a really good one. But it has to be In the Mood for Love, I think. And the actual moment is when she says, they're talking about how one of them is going to leave. And she says, well, can we practice first or whatever? And it's like, I don't understand what you're talking about. And then we see them like having a breakup basically. And then you realize they were play acting, and like that whole situation was so, so good. Yeah. Probably one of my favorite moments of this whole box set. So had to choose that one for, I guess that's maybe not exactly a breakup either, 'cause they weren't exactly together, but you know, yeah.
When I think of like an actual traditional breakup, obviously there are a couple in Days of Being Wild and Happy Together is all about a prolonged breakup. So
yeah,
maybe like if you were going to pick a favorite breakup, that's not just a scene. It would be like that whole movie.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be a good one too. Oh, I should have done favorite sex scene. Oh, well, it's too late. I haven't done research for that.
We're talking right now.
Let's see.
You can go through the films.
I mean, because I was thinking about the beginning of Happy Together, and that's a memorable one for sure. But it would probably be something from 2046.
See, I would think The Hand.
The Hand is definitely memorable, but probably like the sexiest would be in 2046 with him and Bai Ling. Yeah, some of those are pretty steamy, but. So there's that surprise category. Did you have anything for that?
No, I just like the flashback in The Hand, you know, when he shows
up.
And
yeah, the flashback in The Hand is
is
intense. Yeah. Well, the next one I had was going to be about misconnections. That's such a theme that we've been talking about all the time. It's like in all of these movies, there's like relationships that almost happen but don't, or it's not always even romantic relationships. But anyway, what is your either saddest or favorite, whatever, misconnection?
The ringing phone booth in Days of Being Wild.
Ah, yes. That's a good one. Yeah, I didn't think of that. But yeah, that's a really good one. I thought about, again, like if we want to say basically the whole movie of In the Mood for Love would categorize that, but I'm not going to choose that. My favorite is actually in Days of Being Wild, but it's with Yeti and his birth mother. So there's that scene where he finally finds where she is, and then she won't let him in the house to see her. And it's like, and he's like searching, like travel to find her. And then it's him walking away and his voiceover. And it's like, it's heartbreaking, I think is why it's so memorable. But he says like, I know she's watching me out the window, but I'm not going to give her the satisfaction of seeing my face. I'm not going to keep my back to her. And it's just like the vitriol that he has in that moment. And also it's, Leslie Cheung, and he's probably one of my favorite performers of everything. I did not choose him for my favorite performance for the next thing, but I wanted to have something with him because I think he is so good in this and in Happy Together as well. Two categories left. Next up would be favorite performance in innies, and this was a tough one for me. I'm curious, do you have like any runners up, or who did you choose?
Yeah, this one's tough. Obviously, I just feel like going through these categories is going to seem like my favorite film would be Days of Being Wild, although I don't think that's the case. But certainly, Leslie Cheung in Days of Being Wild would be up there in terms of performances. Tony Leung in The Mood for Love is probably going to be my winner.
All right, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, it's so subtle, you know. He does so much with so little in terms of movement. Like he can convey so much. He's so skilled.
Yeah, I absolutely thought about that. And like, I almost had to go with Tony Leung. I mean, Tony Leung in several of these could win, you know, in The Mood for Love probably is the strongest, I would agree. Although if you ask Tony Leung, he would say Days of Being Wild, right? His 30 seconds on screen is his favorite performance that he's done. But ultimately I had to go with Faye Wong in Chungking Express. Mm-hmm. I think that performance is so like energetic and so kind of arresting. It's like a totally different, you know, opposite spectrum of Tony Leung in any of these, especially in The Mood for Love, where it's so subtle. It's kind of the opposite end, but I think it's so good. And I guess that goes along with my music choice there too, is her singing but you that know song for like so many of those scenes.
Well, what's great is sort of like, because they're in that segment together, the way they just kind of balance each other out. And so, yeah, I think that's a good showcase. And I think it's about personal preference, because there's nothing like Faye Wong's performance is not bad, right? But it is very, it's broad, you know, it's like very physical, you know, like it harks back to like screwball comedy or something. And like, she's like very physically gifted. So it's a completely different style. And seeing that match with Tony Leung, I think is really interesting.
And that, just remembering that, made me think, you know, what I could have said for favorite sex scene is the in Chungking Express with Tony Leung and the stewardess, which is not exactly a sex scene, but like, you know, that whole sequence is really, really good. Anyway, enough about, I keep talking about sex. Sorry, you guys. next up, let's talk about our favorite film. So your best picture, your favorite best film out of the whole box set. Was this a hard choice for you?
I don't think so. You know, going into this, it would have been In the Mood for Love. I think it's still In the Mood for Love. I think of that as the perfect film. It's like, it's a perfect film, right? Like, and I think Tony Raines kind of goes too far when he says like, Wonka Wai sort of like chasing that or like can't top it. But right. But I mean, man, it's so, so perfectly realized as a movie. Mm-hmm. Especially considering the circumstances under which it was made, how it was made.
Yeah. That's my choice too. Yeah. I thought about the others and I thought about, maybe Chungking Express, but it had to be In the Mood for Love. It was my first time seeing it. And, yeah, it just blew me away. It's so good. I thought it's interesting that when you look at other people that rate others more highly, like I think the IndieWire official Wong Kar-wai ranking has 2046 at the top, which I think is pretty interesting. And then it was some critic list, you said, put Fallen Angels ahead of Chungking Express.
Yeah, it was like an end of the century poll, right? Yeah, it was like end of the century poll. So I guess In the Mood for Love had not come out yet, but like either Chungking Express or Days of Being Wild to me are easily
be better. Yeah,
more enjoyable than 2046. Not 2046,
Fallen Angels. Yes. Yes. Well,
maybe also 2046. I don't know. I really like Days of Being Wild a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's interesting. So that was like, what, second in the whole box that I was still, you know, getting to know Wong Kar-wai. It'll be interesting next time I go back and watch these, which will probably be, I don't know, a couple of years down the road or something. Kind of rewatching them now with the knowledge of his later films will be kind of an interesting thing. But yes, In the Mood for Love is also my favorite. It's so perfect. You put it really well. It's like so many things work together so wonderfully, and the performances, the set design, the music, all of it is just so great. So In the Mood for Love is my pick as well. And that kind of wraps up. I have a note here, like final thoughts for the whole series. I don't really know what to say. Like, we've said so much, but I'm really glad that we delved in this way. It's something I wanted to do for, you know, any filmmaker. And I think this is a perfect one to kind of do in the podcast for the first time.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I'm surprised about, I think in retrospect, is how, as we went on, the fact that these are restorations did not continue to come up. We kind of, you know, we talked about that the first few, and I just did not notice anything that made me like regret purchasing the set or like inviting people to watch it. And I think sort of getting Wong Kar-wai's perspective on sort of what these films are, or even Chris Doyle talking about how we had to like sort of like go with the past and not be so precious with things, I think it's sort of a good mindset to have in terms of how you approach these things. And I'm glad that we have the versions of these films that we have, you know.
Yeah. I completely agree. And I think you pretty much nailed it the first time we talked about this, and just that, like, yeah, we can be precious about, oh, I want this old version, but there's, even then, there's so many different versions, and we've talked about so many of these, like, there's a cut that played con, then there's a cut that was on the original DVD, and so it's like, which one are we even trying to get back to? But yeah, I think the ones we have here all look really great. There wasn't any, and again, I wasn't watching these for years and years, and so, and maybe that's a very different experience, but there was nothing in the coloring that I thought looked terrible or anything like that. Like, it all seemed to work well for me as far as
right. Like, I think the set. At least through Chungking Express, I think we tried to make a point of sort of talking about what was cut, and then we just stopped. And that wasn't, there was no conversation about it. It was just like, we don't need to harp on that.
Yeah, I was kind of done talking about it.
Yeah.
But yeah. Well, there you go. Wong Kar-wai, World of Wong Kar-wai, wonderful box set. I think it is interesting to, you know, comparing what features are not in this one that were in previous ones. And it's, you know, that I'm sure has to do with the fact that this is a director approved, and he probably didn't like some of the things Tony Raines was saying, and all those kind of things. Like, it definitely, I guess in that way, feels like it has, you know, Wong Kar-wai's actual hands on it. And of course his words are in the book, and he, you know, did all these restorations. So yeah, it just feels like it's, personal in a way, like the whole set is. So yeah, I'm really happy we've gone through it. You mentioned earlier, like, maybe there's another filmmaker we could marathon through at some point. Who are you thinking?
Well, you know what I was thinking, we talked about that, but I was thinking of something a little bit different.
All right.
And so, you know, when we're going through, whether it's this Wong Kar-wai set, or before when we were talking about other directors like Bong Joon-ho, or I Pitch Up Home, Weird Seth Kuhn, that they all referenced directors that were influential to them. And I was thinking, would it be interesting to sort of go back through some of that stuff, pick out some of the films that they say that inspired them, and talk about some of those different types of things.
That's a really cool idea. And so, like, almost watching them together, something older and something newer that was inspired by it. I think that's a really cool idea. Yeah. I've thought about doing sort of a marathon through, like, an actor, like pick six of their movies or something. Cause that could have a much more diverse kind of viewing experience depending on what things they're in. That could be kind of cool. And if it was someone who, like, you know, isn't like a super huge Hollywood name or something, that could be kind of a fun thing. Anyway, I guess we can continue brainstorming. I have a few things lined up for, so generally kind of what I try to do is, like, this has sort of been an art house marathon, and do something more classic. And my friend Rance Collins is such a classic movie nerd that he's the perfect person to talk on those kinds of things. So I'll probably have him back if he's up for it. A more foreign film. I guess these are all foreign films too. Anyway, so we'll probably do this, but it might be a while, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Like, maybe next year we can.
Yeah, 2022.
There you go. Well, I guess we can wrap up. Thank you so much, Ramiya. This has been a very rewarding journey, not only going through these films, but going through them with you. I'm so glad that you joined us for all of these episodes.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, and seriously, we'll do it again. So, all right. Bye-bye. Huge thanks once again to Amaya. This series has been so great. Make sure to tune in next time. We're going to start a new series, which is still in development, so I'm going to hold the details on that for now, but it's something I'm very excited about. And I'm also planning to review the new one from Wes Anderson, The French Dispatch. That plan could change, but that's my hope for right now. And with that, thank you for listening to Arthouse Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes. You can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter. That's at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search @arthousegarage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening, and until next time, keep it snob free.